The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and also with a bonus article from the Saturday Evening Post. Our first article is from the Healthy column, wellness from thehealthy.com. Can I really skip the colonoscopy? For many people, at-home tests may suffice. By Christine Gaspar. My college roommates and I watched Katie Couric make history in 2000 by undergoing a colonoscopy on TV. That memory stuck with me, and more than two decades later, I announced to my doctor that I'd been proactively strategizing for my first one. "Don't worry," I said. "I'm going to take the day off work and spend the afternoon recovering." I was taken aback when he told me I probably wouldn't need to. Not that it wasn't time for me to start screening for colon cancer. In 2018, the American Cancer Society had lowered the recommended age to 45, and in 2021, other organizations followed. But for many people at low risk, me included, thankfully, he said that an at-home screening test was all that was needed. So, no prep, no hospital visit, and no anesthesia, unless the home screening showed something. These days, while colonoscopies are still the gold standard, at a growing number of healthcare organizations, they're no longer the first-line diagnostic to screen for the presence of colon cancer. That's a big convenience. It's challenging for many Americans to plan for a day off from work for the procedure, and possibly another day, another for the day before prep, taking laxatives and spending a lot of time in the bathroom to ensure your colon is cleaned out before the colonoscopy, which consists of a tiny lighted video camera traveling through the colon to look for polyps and other signs of cancer. And colonoscopies are right up there with root canals for things people do not want to do. Good news. The prep has evolved, says Patricia Varacayo, DO, a physician trained in family medicine. It's easier to tolerate and gives a better clean out. But there's still the uncertainty around the insurance coverage for an outpatient procedure that requires anesthesia, which can be a blow to your wallet if it's not covered. For my at-home test, my doctor explained that I'd receive a kit in the mail. I'd collect a stool sample myself and send it back to the company for analysis. If no evidence of cancer was found, I'd be good to go for another year. If you've ever needed a nudge to schedule a routine screening, remember this. There are very few types of cancer for which you can be screened. The Cleveland Clinic reminds us that cancers of the breast, cervix, prostate, and colorectal region are four of the few types that have early detection tests. In 2025, National Cancer Institute data indicated that colorectal cancer is among the top five most diagnosed cancers annually, contributing to nearly 10% of cancer deaths. Many experts emphasize that early detection often leads to better outcomes, which is important because the disease has been on the rise among some groups. These days, around 10% of diagnoses happen in people younger than 50, mostly among those in their 40s, according to the Mayo Clinic. And the average age of a newly diagnosed colorectal cancer patient is now 67, down from 72 less than 20 years ago. If your doctor determines that at-home screening will work for you, three types of kits are available. The fecal immunochemical test, FIT, and the less common guaiac-based fecal occult blood test, GFOBT. Both check for the presence of blood, which may indicate cancer. The third type, such as Cologuard, checks for evidence of DNA shed by cancer cells in the stool, as well as for blood, and may require a larger specimen. A DNA test is recommended every 3 years if results are normal, while the other types of tests are annual. Nadim Anwar, MD, Division Director of Gastroenterology at West Virginia University School of Medicine, says that these kits can be quite effective. The DNA tests are close to 95% accurate, and the FIT test around 75%. The GWIAC-based tests, which are older, generally have lower accuracy rates, and the American Cancer Society recommends that only the newer, highly sensitive versions be used. However, Dr. Anwar stresses, the at-home tests are less than 50% effective at detecting polyps. This is a disadvantage because polyps occur before malignancy develops. This is one reason a colonoscopy is the more thorough route. The scope is more likely to find polyps before cancer is present and can even remove them. So, at-home tests aren't recommended for people who have a personal or family history of colorectal cancer or certain gastrointestinal disorders such as inflammatory bowel disease. If your at-home test shows possible evidence of cancer, you will be referred for a colonoscopy. Dr. Varakayo says some patients will have to cover a greater cost for a colonoscopy that follows an at-home test. So check your insurance and talk to your doctor to determine whether starting with an at-home test makes sense for you. My test kit arrived just days after my 45th birthday. The instructions were simple to follow. Sure, getting up close and personal with the collection container felt weird, but it actually felt like a privilege to grasp steadily onto the test stick as I considered that this easy 5-second task could help rule out an illness that takes more than 50,000 lives in America each year. Suggestion to test kit makers? Include gloves. Some kits do, but mine didn't. Then I packed up the specimen and put it in the prepage return package. Within a few days, my doctor contacted me with the good news that no evidence of cancer had been detected. To be spared the prep, however gentle, and to not miss a day of work was some relief. So was learning that I was in the clear, at least until my next birthday. Every March for Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, my team at thehealthy.com interviews Katie Couric, who nearly 30 years after her first husband, Jay Monahan, passed away at age 42, is still an ardent advocate for screenings. As Couric once told us, my major message is the best test is the one that gets done. That was Can I Really Skip the Colonoscopy? By Christine Gaspar. Our second article from the Reader's Digest is from the sports column, an excerpt from Bigger Than the Game. In sports, some wins mean more than the final score. True champions. Why These High School Hoopers Gave Their Trophy to the Other Team. By Carolyn Fanning. The players on the girls' basketball team at the Academy of Classical Christian Studies in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, knew something wasn't right. Their coach, Brendan King, never contacted them on a Sunday, but on this Sunday, he said he needed them back in the gym. Many players arrived straight from church. Still elated from their championship win the night before, but now jittery. The score had been miscounted in last night's 44-43 win, he told them. Academy had actually lost to their opponents from Apache High School, 43-42. This doesn't take away how proud I am of you guys and how hard we worked to get here, King assured them. Still, it was a bitter pill to swallow. Players asked questions. Was he sure? What did this mean for the rest of their tournament? Together, they debated next steps. Policy states that once the game is finished, it's finished. There's no overturning the final score. But within 20 minutes, the team decided that there was only one thing left to do. Turn the trophy over to the rightful champions, Apache. There wasn't really any hesitation in our minds, team co-captain Sidney Kitchen told the New York Times. The district championship game against Apache was physical and intense. The academy players were the underdogs, and King knew they'd have to play their absolute best for a chance at winning. Scoring was back and forth until the fourth quarter, when Apache pulled away by 14 points with 4 minutes on the clock. King was considering emptying the bench when he called one last timeout. If we want to make one final push to win this game, this is the time to do it, he told his players. Academy came out of the timeout with new energy, playing as if they had nothing to lose, sinking shot after shot to pull within a few points of Apache. Then, with 2 minutes left to go, the referee blew the whistle, stopping play in its tracks. There was a discrepancy between scoreboard and scorebook. The scoreboard had Academy down by 4 points. The scorebook had them down by 2. League rules state that the score defaults to the scorebook. The scoreboard was updated to 43-41, Apache. Play resumed. Academy freshman Lily Payne hit a 3-point buzzer beater to top Apache by a point for the school's first ever district championship. The home crowd rushed the court as players dogpiled on top of one another. But King walked to the locker room with a sinking feeling in his gut. I was like, I need to know if we won that game or not, just for my peace of mind, he says. That night, King sat down at his kitchen table with the game tape. He watched the entire thing through, tallying every point on a notepad. His gut, it turned out, was right. By his count, Academy had lost the game by a point. He watched a second time to be sure. With 3 minutes left in the fourth quarter, just a minute before the referee stopped the game, an Academy shot went up and rolled dubiously around the rim. The crowd roared, sure that it was bound to drop into the basket. But then it didn't. Instead, it came down for a rebound. King suspects that the record keeper had a poor angle and thought it had gone in. At 1 a.m., deflated but relieved to know the truth, King went to bed. When he got up in the morning, he alerted the athletic director and the league's governing body. Then he told the players to meet him at school and broke the news. Next, with his team's support, King made the 90-minute drive to Apache to deliver the trophy to its players. He didn't have to do that, Apache coach Amy Merriweather told the Times. Most coaches wouldn't have. Merriweather also had noticed the error and raised the issue with officials, who had informed her that the score couldn't be overturned. But after reviewing King's report, they made an exception, earning Apache its win on paper, too. I handed them the trophy and told them there's no ill will, and we'd never do this for any crazy reason, says King. They worked just as hard as we did, and I hated that the moment was taken away from them and their families and friends. After King handed over the trophy to them in the gym, the Apache players recreated what would have been the game-winning shot from senior Tatum Howlingwater. This time, she celebrated with the trophy. And now a bonus article from the Saturday Evening Post. Healing Power of Music. More than just entertainment, music is taking a larger role in fighting back against neurological disorders, by Chi Sherman. The notion that music has a profound effect on mind and mood probably does not come as much of a surprise. A single song has the ability to make us laugh or bring us to tears, lift us up when we are down, shake off a bad mood, or motivate us to hit the gym, transport us back in time, or dance like no one is watching. Music strikes a chord with all of us, the universal language. But listening to your favorite tunes does more than just boost your mood. Research shows that music's influence over our biology and health is far-reaching. There is considerable evidence that listening to your favorite tunes can boost physical as well as mental health. including better sleep, more productive workouts, pain reduction, and improved heart health. The idea of music as medicine isn't new. For centuries, music has been a powerful tool for healing. The ancient Egyptians described musical incantations for healing the sick. Greek physicians used flutes and lyres to heal their patients, and vibration to aid digestion and induce sleep. Today, scientists are gaining a better understanding of how and why music affects our bodies and minds. Music therapy is proving to be a powerful treatment for a range of conditions, including chronic pain, stroke, cancer, and Parkinson's disease, and it's increasingly becoming part of patient care. It's important to note that music therapy differs from listening to music for entertainment, relaxation, or stress relief. Though they share some of the same benefits, the goal of music therapy is a practice that uses evidence-backed techniques to address physical, mental, and emotional well-being. Music therapists use both active and receptive, passive, interventions, and create goals to improve health and well-being. In active music therapy, the patient participates making music, often through singing, playing instruments, or movement. Anything from the client rhythmically snapping their fingers to learning a complicated TikTok dance. In contrast, passive interventions invoke patients listening to music rather than actively participating. One of the best facets of music therapy is that people of all ages can benefit, and musical skills are not a requirement. Studies using fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, have shown that listening to music activates virtually every area of the brain. It can also influence our brain chemistry. Listening to a favorite song can trigger the release of endorphins, the body's natural painkillers and mood elevators, and reduce levels of cortisol, the stress hormone. When you listen to music, especially music you enjoy, it also triggers the release of dopamine, a feel-good neurotransmitter associated with pleasure and reward. Get chills when listening to your favorite song? The dopamine rush could be why. Considering the powerful effect that music has on the brain, scientists are trying to harness the transformative power of music to develop non-pharmacological interventions for treating various diseases. Nothing activates the brain so extensively as music, wrote renowned neurologist Oliver Sacks, MD, in his book, Musicophilia. Music can lift us out of depression or move us to tears. It is a remedy, a tonic, orange juice for the ear. But for many of my neurological patients, music is even more. It can provide access, even when no medication can, to movement, to speech, to life. For them, music is not a luxury, but a necessity. Dr. Sacks, who spent years exploring the effects of music on the brain, regarded music therapy as a tool of great power in many neurological disorders, Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, because of its unique capacity to organize or reorganize cerebral function when it has been damaged. Music has been an integral part of the human experience as long as humanity has been around, says neurologist Alexander Patilayat, MD, co-founder and co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Music and Medicine. It's been intuitively felt to have healing properties, but now we are in a position to study the mechanisms and optimize music-based interventions. The Johns Hopkins Center for Music and Medicine is one of the leading institutions investigating the science and therapeutic potential of music to help treat conditions like Parkinson's, stroke, and Alzheimer's. The center is exploring the impact of music and rhythm-based therapies on Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, stroke, and a number of other disorders. Recent studies conducted by Patilayat found that regular choir, guitar, or drum sessions help patients with Parkinson's disease improve their movement and coordination, as well as their mood. We're using music therapy, music-based based interventions and rhythm based interventions for the purposes of improving symptoms, quality of life, and healing various illnesses, says Pantelayat, adding that the center's focus has largely been on neurological illness to date, neurodegenerative conditions like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. But that research continues to explore other conditions, including those related to cardiac health. Music has always been very near and dear to my heart, he says, Dr. Pantelayat, an accomplished musician and violinist himself, who in 2015 started investigating the benefits of choral singing on Parkinson's disease patients through his Parkinsonics program. After just a few months into the Parkinsonic choral program, Pantelayat observed that singing together in the group has helped increase participants' vocal volume and clarity, rhythmic movement, and confidence of emotional expression, while cultivating a sense of community, noting how participants were able to get a break from their illness and focus on creativity. Music therapy can and often does have a movement component. Dance has been shown to have beneficial effects on the brain and is now being used to treat people with Parkinson's disease. Several studies that came out, particularly Washington University in St. Louis, showed that pursuing ballroom dance really improved various symptoms in Parkinson's disease overall, and particularly mobility, walking, and balance, says Dr. Pantelayat. An activity like dancing for an hour a couple of times a week can help a patient improve their walking balance and, more importantly, stay improved, which, Pantelayat says, is no small task in the face of a progressive neurodegenerative condition like Parkinson's disease. One of Pantelayat's patients found success by taking ballroom dance lessons, notably the Argentine tango. Inherently, it makes sense because in Parkinson's disease, steps get smaller to the point of shuffling and sometimes even freezing, which is a phenomenon, freezing of gait, where your feet get stuck to the ground. You're trying to turn around, you're trying to walk through a doorway, and it's not possible to do that in severe cases, he explains. These are the kinds of things that Argentine tango counteracts by targeting very large steps in every direction. So it's literally the opposite of what happens to patients. Laurie DePorter first met Dr. Pantelayat in 2015 to get a second opinion after being diagnosed at age 45 with early onset Parkinson's disease. At that first meeting, Pantelayat suggested dance therapy. Though DePorter never took dance lessons before her diagnosis, she threw herself into the practice, taking lots of private dance lessons with her husband. The Argentine tango is very hard, says DePorter. I really had to concentrate and understand my body. In addition to serving as global ambassador for the Parkinson and Movement Disorder, PMD, Alliance, she teaches exercise classes for others with Parkinson's. I incorporate music and dance into classes I teach, she says. We drum, we box to a beat using drumsticks, or punch to music. I teach how to hit a speed bag to a waltz rhythm. DePorter encourages people with Parkinson's to stay active and find an activity they like to do, because anything you do is training for the brain. Try to do everything big, because Parkinson's makes you small, she says. Bust a move anywhere. It's not how you dance, it's that you dance. Treatments for Parkinson's disease and conditions like stroke extend beyond dancing and singing. Rhythmic auditory stimulation is a neurologic music therapy rehabilitation technique in which patients synchronize footsteps to a metronome or musical beats to improve their gait. The technique is, according to Dr. Pantelayat, probably the best-studied approach in many ways for behavioral-type outcomes. Music-based interventions that patients can pursue outside of clinical sessions are a vital part of the music therapy process as well. They can include self-directed components, such as having a person with dementia curate their own music list. If I talk to my patients with Alzheimer's type dementia and ask them to put together a playlist of their favorite songs and then tell them to listen to it for 30 minutes a day at home, that's an example of music medicine, says the neurologist. Choosing music that patients recognize and like can help Alzheimer's patients connect with a part of the self they may have forgotten. Experts recommend using recorded music on a CD or other physical format instead of music streaming online. Multiple ad interruptions may be confusing to the patient and can take everyone involved out of the therapeutic mental space. Avoiding commercials is a good way to maintain the music's volume as well, which can help promote a stress-free environment for the therapy session. It's best to focus solely on the musical stimuli, being careful to silence distractions like other media or cell phones. Diseases like Alzheimer's can greatly affect a patient's dignity and humanity, and music therapy is a route back to the self. We all need more music in our lives because it serves to bring people together to promote social cohesion, Panteliat says. Sharing musical experiences with family and friends or other like-minded individuals can be a profoundly healing experience. That was The Healing Power of Music by Chai Sherman from the Saturday Evening Post. We have now run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.